Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news, all relating to the economic hostage crisis on Capitol Hill that shows some signs of being resolved before Social Security checks have to go out on Wednesday. An expert on government, Paul Light, joins us to discuss how the Republicans seem to have won in spite of having manufactured this crisis to achieve their policy goals through extortion by threatening to damage an already weak economy which the Democrats will be running on next year. Then we'll get an overseas perspective on how this self-inflicted economic wound looks like from abroad. The director of Columbia University's Earth Institute, Jeffrey Sachs, joins us to assess what seems to be a suicide pact that President Obama is expected to sign, an austerity package that will kill our faltering economic recovery and undermine the foundation of the Democratic Party, leading to the likelihood of third parties and primary challenges emerging next year. Then we'll look at the moral questions raised by the actions of a few wealthy white men who call themselves Christians, who are about to unnecessarily impoverish millions of their fellow Americans in order to form a more perfect disunion. Jim Wallace, the CEO of Sojourners and author of Rediscovering Values on Wall Street, Main Street, and Your Street, joins us to shine a light on this hypocrisy, meanness, and ideological cruelty. Joining us now is Paul Light, who is the Paulette Goddard Professor of Public Service at New York University and the founding principal investigator of the Global Center for Public Service. Previously, he served as the founding director of the Center for Public Service and director of the Governmental Studies Program at the Brookings Institution. His books include Thickening Government and The Tides of Reform. Welcome to Background Briefing, Paul Light.
Thank you for having me.
And I guess at this point, what's the latest in the Capitol Hill follies here, Paul Light? I take it that now the Senate's voted down the Speaker's proposal, Harry Reid's proposal?
Well, the Senate voted down the Majority Leader's proposal, but that appears to be a precursor for further negotiations that might lead to a package. You have to defeat everything before you clear the decks to pass something. So you got to give everybody a voice in expressing their ideological position, which we saw in the House, now we've seen in the Senate, and perhaps you now set the stage for some serious negotiating that has probably been underway for 24 to 72 hours.
And we know little about it. We've known little about it all along, and there's been a lot of speculation, and I think you have to always have that caveat. But what we know from David Plouffe, the senior advisor to Mr. Obama, and he, of course, is his election guru, who is looking towards the 2012 elections, he said that the package includes $1 trillion in cuts and would set up a congressional commission that would report to Congress in the fall with a plan for additional changes amounting to a trillion or more. Is that your understanding?
That's my understanding. I think the American public and the international community will look at it and say, you know, this is some sort of Rube Goldberg mechanism for trying to get something done that might actually impress the global financial markets, but I'm not sure it will. You're just passing buck to a congressional committee that may or may not be able to act. And there's been a long history of these kinds of commissions that have produced exactly nothing in terms of actual results.
And in terms of what has been up until now a bottom line for the president and for the Democrats, which is revenues, there's no indication there are any revenues in the package.
Not that I can see, but you don't know what's happening in the private negotiations around coming up with that trillion-dollar figure. Perhaps they'll get something, but it's doubtful. John Boehner, the Speaker of the House, cannot deliver votes to actually increase revenues, close loopholes, or adjust the alternative minimum tax, as we call it, to produce any kind of useful revenue enhancements. So basically what's happened is that the Democrats are folding to the Republican House because the House is proven repeatedly in the past 3 or 4 weeks that it will not pass a balanced agreement. And by balance, we're really defining the term down to mean maybe 80% spending cuts and 20% revenue enhancements. I mean, that doesn't sound like balance to me, but that's how the term has been defined here, maybe 90-10. So I don't think Boehner can deliver his numbers. I don't think that the House will pass any revenue enhancers. They're going to cut spending.
And the House is staying firm on maintaining the tax breaks for the 1%, the wealthiest Americans.
I think that's a reasonable way of putting it. Yes, you know, revenues are essentially left untouched, and there's a lot of accounting gimmickry and where the deficit cuts come from. I don't know whether the emerging package will include cuts or savings related to the wind down of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, which our Congressional Budget Office, the office responsible for scoring savings, there's some indication that they will not score the wind down as a cut. And therefore, the question will be, well, what's really in a package of cuts, and are they real?
Again, I'm speaking with Paul Light, who is the Paulette Goddard Professor of Public Service at New York University, and he served as the founding director of the Center for Public Service and director of the Governmental Studies Program at the Brookings Institution. And obviously the president made an attempt to shame the Republicans by talking about corporate jets, subsidies and tax breaks, and how the Republicans were going to the mat for the millionaires and billionaires. That hasn't worked. But polls indicate that most Americans think that the disparity in wealth in this country is alarming and growing, that they don't think this is a fair situation. So what does it say about our democracy? We're a small minority of insurgents who were formed, the Tea Party was formed as a result of outrage over what happened on Wall Street, but they've turned out to be the most zealous defenders of I don't know whether you could say Wall Street, but they're certainly the most zealous defenders of billionaires.
Well, I think that's true. I think there are a lot of Democrats who are also diehard defenders of upper income earners in the United States. I think that President Obama made a modest attempt to explain this problem to Americans, but I don't think he laid enough detail on the table to make the case. Yes, Americans think that the wealthiest in this country are undertaxed, but the corporate jet example has not particularly penetrated the consciousness. The public is generally supportive of revenue increases of one kind or another, but the devil is always in the details, and Republicans have managed to stake out the higher ground, arguing that any tax increase, even closing the loophole on corporate jets, will somehow destroy the economy, and that's been the prevailing wisdom in the House. People have locked themselves in on it, and you cannot get a bill through the House with any kind of revenue enhancer. You just can't. And they have proven, the House has proven this over and over. The Democrats are folding right now in order to get the debt ceiling raised, and that's just what's going to happen, I think. But we still don't know the fine point in the Harry Reid's proposal. We don't know what the minority leader, Mitch McConnell, will do, but I suspect that revenues are not going to be part of this, that the House will just tear it apart. They're willing to put the economy in jeopardy in order to make their case.
Well, you would think, though, given that that is obvious, Paul Light, it is extraordinary to think that the Republicans have won on the policy grounds. They've gotten what they wanted, or they appear to be about to get what they want, and yet they haven't suffered a catastrophic blow in terms of public opinion. It seems that Well, in part, I think the problem is the way our media is structured, where everything is equal and opposite, you know, where you have to have the pro and con. So therefore, you know, they're equal arguments, if you will, even though it's only one side that is threatening to destroy the economy if they don't get 100% of what they want. That doesn't seem to be coming across. I think what's coming across to the American people is that these people on Washington who are supposed to be doing the people's business are absolutely out of control, and the public are just disgusted.
I think that's a good summary of it. I think that the legislative process in the United States is very, very cumbersome, difficult to understand. The maneuvering is difficult to follow. It's all been front and center in the media coverage. It's been treated as a horse race kind of event. Republicans were first to the floor with a proposal. They passed it. They passed a balanced budget amendment. They will claim that they made the first moves, that the president was slow to engage, et cetera, et cetera. So they have a slight edge on this. I think Americans are just disgusted with, you know, Washington. And I think Obama gets hurt. I think Democrats get hurt, but I think, you know, Republicans and incumbents from all of the parties get hurt in this, and I suspect that you'll see a very large number of people nominated next year who will basically be out of a, you know, Washington needs to be reformed kind of position, and that will be more Tea Party activists, I would guess, possibly a third party effort, you know, to basically say both parties don't work. You get a candidate who's going to make the case that he or she is not of Washington and therefore they can fix it. But third-party movements have been notoriously poorly financed and unsuccessful. Our system is configured to produce a two-party system and to knock out third-party candidates with relative ease.
Well, that doesn't mean, though, Paul Light, that a third party can't act as a spoiler, as Ralph Nader did in 2000 in Florida, helping elect George W. Bush. And it seems very likely that there will be a third, a challenge to Obama from his left. Don't you think?
You know, but a third party built around changing Washington would probably carve more into the Republican base than the Democratic base. Obama may face a challenge from the left. He may face a challenge from his own right, you know, centrist Democrats. It's going to be independent voters in this country that are going to determine the next election, and it's not yet clear which party they'll side with or whether they'll go with the third party. And I would guess that a third party candidate with enough credibility and a strong message might get 8-10% of the vote in the 2012 election, and that would be enough to change the outcome quite significantly. I wouldn't bet on Obama right now. I think he's in a very weak position. The economy is struggling. He's going to have to run with an economy with 9-10% unemployment. He's not looking real good right now, and I don't know how he can shift the debate away from the economic issue and onto the debt ceiling debate. This one will be forgotten relatively quickly, but the anger will continue, and that may favor a strong third party, and I would guess right now that Obama is quite vulnerable if the Republicans nominate somebody with enough credibility to make the anti-Washington case.
So what explains then, how did the Republicans win by threatening to ruin the economy? Is it that cynical that a bad economy helps them?
I think yes, actually. I think that Obama was able for the first 2 years of his presidency to blame the economic conditions on his predecessor, George W. Bush, but it's his economy now. And Republicans are basically saying, look, you know, we've got to get our credit card in order here. They've used the credit card analogy effectively to say that you can't get your credit card under control without cutting your purchases. They've just been more effective on the issue. Obama has had a very sophisticated argument, but it often comes across as professorial when he presents it. And I don't think most Americans quite understand how he got into this mess. I don't think they quite understand much beyond the fact that Washington's leaders have been behaving like anything but courageous leaders. So kind of a pox on everyone's house, and that invites a third party, that invites activists on the left and right during the nomination season. It's going to be quite a ride over the next 18 months or so.
And Paul Light, what explains the ability of the Republicans to leverage power the way that they do? For example, they are the minority in the Senate, but for the longest time they've held this new rule that there's no such thing as a majority vote anymore. That it's got to be a supermajority with a filibuster proof.
How do they do it?
How do they get away with it? You're a student of government. What's the psychology here, or the lack thereof, on the Democratic side to accede to this usurpation of power?
Well, the U.S. system of government was designed to favor strong minorities in these kinds of debates, especially in the Senate with the filibuster. And so, this is a government that was designed by our founders to not work very well. It was not supposed to produce grand policy agreements without intense public support and intense majority support, far exceeding the 50% plus one rule that we're all accustomed to. So here we have a system that's easily exploited through checks and balances. We've got a leader in the House who cannot control his own troops. We saw that in the wild battle for simple passage of a relatively small bill the other night. Finally did win passage, but it was a squeaker. But this is a system that's easily exploited for advantage by a very strong House or a very reluctant Senate. And it's just the way the system was designed, but it's very easily exploited. That was the hope by the founders, incidentally. They didn't want things to pass regularly. They wanted there to be, lots of checks and balances and leverage points. And the Republicans have done a very good job with their message on the debt ceiling and marshaling their troops to extort concessions, and the Democrats have basically folded. They're basically saying, okay, we can't get any revenue enhancements, so we'll give Republicans $1 trillion, $1.5 trillion, maybe a little bit more in benefit cuts, spending cuts. And some of them will be real, some of them won't be real.
Mm. It sounds like a political version of the Stockholm Syndrome, where you're nice to your torturer, you know?
Well, that could be it, or it could be a political version of waiting for Godot. I do think something will pass at 11:59 and 59 seconds on p.m. on August 1st. The American public, I think by that point and already to this point, are just fed up with it. Washington couldn't be more unpopular. Congress is the most unpopular, but that's not what's going to play out in the coming elections. Republicans, I think, have it right that the public will support them and that the public's intense dislike of taxes will help Republicans in the coming election season.
Boy, it just makes you realize when Obama came in with that big majority the Democrats had, that was the time to strike, and they didn't do it. They didn't have a big enough stimulus, and they allowed the Republicans to cut the stimulus down 40% with tax breaks, and then the Republicans, after negotiating with them, didn't give them one vote. If that didn't tell him out of the gate what's going on, I don't know what it takes, but.
Right. At the time, it was basically the Republicans sitting around saying, well, you know, how can we set the stage for 2012 and 2010? And the answer was, we'll oppose everything and we'll stay in line. And at the time, many pundits were saying, well, this is not going to work, Democrats are going to get their stimulus, et cetera, et cetera. But it wasn't, as you say, it wasn't big enough, and joblessness has remained very, very high. And maybe that was the time to strike with a much larger stimulus and then hold off on health care reform until 2013. But Democrats went ahead. Republicans won a major victory in 2010, and I think they're playing it out, saying, well, what worked in 2010 will work in 2012, and they may be right.
Well, it is a, it's an extraordinary situation, I must say, to see something that seemed to me to be so out of control, to be such flagrant kind of extortion, and such an unnecessary and reckless thing to do, to threaten the full faith and credit of the United States,
and to get
away with it.
Well, I, you know, look, I've been watching this from inside Washington and out. I was on Capitol Hill as a fellow for several years in the 80s during the Social Security crisis, when leaders stepped up and did what was for the good of the nation, not necessarily for their own electoral advantage. I've never seen anything like this. It is the most damaging moment of the last 6-8 weeks, the most damaging moment for public confidence in government that I have ever seen, and I think most people who watch this would agree. You know, in terms of public confidence in government, the consent of the governed, I think that we're hitting new lows, and I think it'll take a long time for the public to gain any confidence out of toward Washington. It's just going to take a generation, perhaps, to recover from this kind of mess. It's not just what's in the package, it's how the negotiations have gone forward. It's been, really, if I can use the word, just a disgusting display of Washington's inability to reach consensus on an issue of obvious national concern.
Well, so Paul Light, I thank you for joining us here today.
It's a very absolutely, my pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Paul Light, who is the Paulette Goddard Professor of Public Service at New York University, previously was Director of Governmental Studies Program at the Brookings Institution. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be joined by Jeffrey Sachs. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Joining me now is Jeffrey Sachs, who's the director of the Earth Institute and professor of sustainable development and professor of health policy and management at Columbia University. He's also a special advisor to United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, and from 2002 to 2006, he was director of the UN Millennium Project and special advisor to United Nations Secretary General Kofi Annan on the Millennium Development Goals. He's also president and co-founder of Millennium Promise Alliance, a nonprofit organization aimed at ending extreme global poverty. He's also a member of the Institute for Medicine and a research associate of the National Bureau of Economic Research, and he has an article in the Huffington Post, Budgetary Deceit and America's Decline. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jeffrey Sachs.
good to be with you. Thanks very much.
And you've been traveling from Greece, where there's they're teetering on default. You've been to East Africa, where there's famine threatening 10 million people, and now you're in the Gulf. So you've been able to sort of see this train wreck on Capitol Hill from abroad. What is the sense that you have, having been in countries that have real problems, and here you are watching the United States go through this totally manufactured crisis that is obviously a major self-inflicted wound?
Well, I can tell you, first of all, that all around the world, people are amazed, of course, at this contraption that we call our political system, what a mess it is right now, how irresponsible the politicians are. So I'm getting asked a lot of questions about what indeed is a completely manufactured crisis. I explained today to a lot of leaders in the Gulf that there's no sense in which the U.S. Has run out of money and is being forced to default. This is a manufactured crisis that, in the end, I think is going to end up doing a tremendous amount of damage, further damage to the U.S. economy and to U.S. politics. It's a very sad thing to watch the spectacle from afar, especially given that the U.S. is essentially totally absent these days from any global problem solving. I was in Nairobi recently with Prime Minister Raila Odinga of Kenya, strategizing about how to address this famine, which has gripped the Horn of Africa after two complete failed years of no rain, probably the result of man-made climate change globally impacting this impoverished region. And the U.S. is just not part of the picture. We used to care about such things. We used to help. We used to do things. And, of course, we're focusing on this manufactured crisis, as you put it, at a time when millions of people's lives are completely endangered and the U.S. is nowhere to be seen.
But what's particularly disturbing about this, Jeffrey Sachs, is that you would think that the party responsible for the extortion and the blackmail and for this reckless behavior would be punished. But it looks like they've won on the policy ground. They've clearly won. There's no revenues in this package as far as we can tell. It's all cuts. And it seems that the public is sort of, their attitude is it's a plague on all your houses. And of course, the press contributes to this because of this slavish formula of balance, thesis, antithesis, synthesis, where everything's an equal and opposite argument.
Well, I'm going to add to that in one sense, which is that I am thoroughly disgusted with the Democrats as well as with the Republicans and with the White House, which I think has... And the president, I mean, I think he's just done a very, very poor job in all of this. And the Democrats have their share of the blame also, because really the Democrats over the last 20 years have been the party of Wall Street. The Republicans mainly have been the party of big oil. It's not been a huge amount to choose from. And in the meantime, we don't have a government that functions. The idea that the response is to slash further, which is what seems to be about to be agreed imminently, is going to cause further damage to the large part of America's population that is suffering badly, unemployed, without the education or skills or health or environmental safety or other needs. Because both parties have become caterers to the rich and powerful. And in this sense, there is a kind of symmetry and balance. And President Obama has not stood up for basic principles of what used to be the Democratic Party. I don't know what that party stands for anymore, but he's not stood up for core principles. And I guess that what looks again from afar, and I'm perhaps too far away to really know what's about to be announced, but it looks like an agreement of cutting without any response to tax the millionaires and billionaires that really have made off like bandits during the last 20 years, and many of them have been bandits. And there's no accountability in our system, and seems like there's no interest in either party to holding anybody accountable for the mess or accountable for some basic responsibility and civic virtue in our society. We've just lost all of that. And it is both parties, and it is the White House, and it is a shame, and it is a mess.
Again, I'm speaking with Jeffrey Sachs, who's the director of Columbia University's Earth Institute, and we'll be talking in a little while with Jim Wallace of Sojourners about the moral questions raised by the actions of these few wealthy men, all of whom have health care coverage on Capitol Hill, many of whom call themselves Christians, who are about to unnecessarily impoverish millions of their fellow Americans for ideological reasons. But before we get into that discussion, I'd like to get back to you, Jeffrey Sachs, about just the politics of it in terms of survival. This looks like a suicide pact that President Obama is about to sign, and an austerity package that will kill our faltering economy. And when you go back to the beginning of the Obama administration, when they had that big majority and the Democrats had a big majority, it looks as like that was the only time they could have struck. And they came in small with a small stimulus. The money's run out. That's why the economy is dragging to a halt. And there's no chance of another stimulus. So do you trace it back to that first vote? Because remember what happened there. The White House negotiated with Senator Grassley. They cut the stimulus down by 40% in terms of tax breaks as opposed to cash. All that money's run out. It was too little. And look where we're at now. We're about to go the opposite direction, more austerity. It makes absolutely no economic sense.
Well, let me give you a slightly different take, which maybe adds to the complication of all of this. I was actually against the stimulus at the beginning, and for reasons that I think were borne out, not that it was too big or too small, but that it was wrongly conceived. Basically, we need government to be doing critical things if the U.S. is to be a healthy and functioning society, a decent society, and an internationally competitive society. We need government that is able to rebuild our infrastructure, government that is able to help ensure that all Americans, not just rich Americans, can get a decent education. We need a government that can help to ensure that we have a functioning energy system that can address the growing environmental risks and growing risks of dependence on a depleting stock of global oil. In other words, we need government to be doing critical things. I was against the stimulus bill, so-called, because I'm not especially a Keynesian economist who believes that the main function of government is to, quote, increase aggregate demand. I'm an economist who believes that the role of government is to carry out functions that markets don't carry out, like the ones that I mentioned on infrastructure, science, technology, environmental protection, help for the poor, and so on. So when Obama came in, I did not want in 4 weeks throwing money at the economy under the rubric of aggregate demand or stimulus. I thought that that would look irresponsible, would be irresponsible, and would prevent us from doing what really needs to be done, which is to have a serious government that makes serious long-term plans and carries them out consequently and gives confidence to people that their money, their tax dollars, are being properly used. So this puts me in a little bit of an odd position, I must say. I think Paul Krugman has been wrong repeatedly in saying all we need to do or what we should have done is throw even more money at these problems, but throw money. That what counts is whether it's tax cuts or spending increases, just raise demand. We need something far more sophisticated than that. We need a government that identifies the needs in our society and makes serious, long-term steps to carry out the things that markets won't solve, but carry them out consequently, effectively, transparently, not wasting money, not giving tax breaks to rich people and rich companies to pile up even more money, not adding it up as, quote, aggregate demand, but looking at it in terms of the core functions of government. This is where I really fault President Obama, but I also fault a lot of the lazy advice that he was given. We never in this administration have had a serious look at the things that government needs to do. Obama's idea of infrastructure was shovel-ready projects. How absurd. We need a serious rebuilding of America's infrastructure. They weren't shovel-ready. They needed analysis. They needed 21st century technologies, not shovels. And we never had that. We've never had an energy plan. We've never had a forward-looking strategy for improving science, technology, and American competitiveness. We've given the idea, and unfortunately too many Democrats bought it also, that the role of government is to stimulate. And this is, in the end, not convincing to the public. It looks like throwing money after problems, not solving problems. It discredited government. And at this point, Obama's throwing out government, it seems. Of course, we'll see what happens in the next day. But he, from what he's been saying in recent days, really ought to run in the Republican primaries, because basically he's talking about how much can we cut government. And there is no attention to these core needs, which used to be the basic philosophy of the party that he leads. And this is, I think, the big problem, not that the stimulus was too small, but that we never had a strategy, never had plans, never thought out the basic fact that in America, the government is not carrying out its role, and the United States is becoming a society divided between rich and poor, a society not developing the skills for the 21st century, and a society losing international competitiveness. And it's adding up to a growing economic disaster. And there is no plan to get us out. And basically, we're going to see government slashed further. We're going to see tax cuts more for the rich, because both the Democrats and the Republicans listen to their big campaign contributors and the powerful companies that back them up. And that's the tragedy of our system right now and the mess of our economy.
Just in the last minute, Jeffrey Sachs, how do you change the national debate? Who does this? In other words, the anti-government thing has gone on for so long that it's almost in the political DNA. Obviously, the question shouldn't be about how much tax you pay, and we pay very little anyway compared to the rest of the world. It's what you get back.
That's absolutely right.
And it's what you get back for your taxes, should be the argument. We don't have a polity here where people understand, like in other social democracies, that you pay your taxes and you get your government services. Nobody see, and what we have in terms of government services are now on the chopping block.
You said it exactly right, and that's why we need a third party, I believe, to start with, because both these parties are in the hands of corporate interests and the millionaire and billionaire campaign contributors. So is the White House. We are ending basically core government services that people depend on, and that we depend on to have an effective economy in a highly competitive 21st century. We need to have a new kind of politics. It's happened before in American history. It happened during the Progressive Era when basically a third party attack on two parties that represented, as today, the Gilded Age vested interests became vulnerable to the real demands of the public. And I believe that this is what is needed in America today, because it's not going to come from the political parties. It's not going to come from the White House. We have no change that we were promised. We really were hoodwinked. This has been bait and switch. Change you can believe in, and then what we have is more of the same from both parties. And again, I'm judging and a little bit from afar, since I'm several thousand miles away from the United States. But from what I'm seeing, it really looks like we're going to see government slashed, exactly the opposite of what we need. We don't need government slashed. We need government to be effective now. And we need a social and political movement in our country that understands that certain things we need don't simply come from the rich and the companies. They come from our shared political action. And we need, and I think most Americans understand that intuitively and would rally behind a movement that says it's time for effective government, not shutting down government.
I thank you so much for joining us here today, Jeffrey Sachs.
Good to speak with you. Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters, just speaking then with Jeffrey Sachs, Director of the Earth Institute, Professor of Sustainable Development and Professor of Health Policy and Management at Columbia University. He's also a Special Advisor to United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, and he is also a Research Associate at the National Bureau of Economic Research. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking with Jim Wallace. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Jim Wallace, who is the President and CEO of Sojourners and Editor-in-Chief of Sojourner Magazine. Jim Wallace recently served as the President's Advisory Council on Faith-Based and Neighborhood Partnerships and currently serves as the Chair of Global Agenda Council on Faith for the Working Economic Forum. The World Economic Forum. His best-selling books include The Great Awakening, Reviving Faith and Politics in a Post-Religious Right America, God's Politics, Why the Right Gets It Wrong and the Left Doesn't Get It, and his latest, Rediscovering Values on Wall Street, Main Street, and Your Street, A Moral Compass for the New Economy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jim Wallace.
Thank you, Ian.
And it looks as though, paradoxically, the people who essentially created an economic hostage crisis extorted their demands at the threat of ruining the full faith and credit of the United States, looks like they're going to be rewarded. I mean, I'm astounded. What's happened? I want to talk to you about the country's moral compass, but let's start with its political compass.
Well, as you just suggest, the people who got us into this mess are the only ones whose lives have returned to normal, and everybody else is still struggling here. We're watching. I'm watching as we speak these debates now in the Senate this afternoon, and you know, the markets are watching, and the Democrats, Republicans are watching. The media is doing its political handicapping: who's going to win, who's going to lose. The world is watching, and in the faith community, we form the circle of protection around those who are at the other end of the spectrum. Those who are most vulnerable and who are really in trouble in this debate. And we say God's watching this debate as well. We've been meeting with the president, with Republicans, Democrats. I finally got my meeting with Mitch McConnell. It was in the makeup room of CNN this morning. I was leaving, and he was coming. And I said, Senator, the faith community is pleading with you to protect low-income people in this final deal. This is for us imperative. And he kept smiling and saying, yes, sir, yes, sir, yes, sir. So I hope he paid attention.
Well, he was confronted yesterday, I believe it was, where by one of the network's reporters who both he and Boehner were standing there with a sort of deer in the headlight look when they were asked about will our troops get their paychecks? And you know that's the bottom line in American politics is this. The moral issues aside, it's when it comes down to the boys and girls fighting and dying for the United States, that's kind of sacrosanct. And frankly, they looked stunned. But obviously, there's some real moral questions raised by the actions of let me put it the way that I put it and see what you think. A few wealthy white men who call themselves Christians, who all of whom have full health care coverage, I might add, who are about to unnecessarily impoverish millions of their fellow Americans.
The broken system, as everyone now refers to in Washington, D.C., it's more than broken, it's corrupt. It's corrupt, as you suggest, because literally, look at what they're about to do. They're going to cut $1 trillion right off the bat, and there's no revenue increase here at all. Then they want to cut $1.8 trillion more with a special super committee in the next few months. But they're literally willing to protect tax loopholes, corporate loopholes for the rich, while they devastate the safety net for the poor. I mean, this isn't just rhetorical. This is what they're doing now. And so I've said again and again, it's every line item of military spending, for example, worth more than 10.4 million malaria bed nets, which they're about to cut, which keep kids from dying from malaria. Women and children getting crucial nutrition. All this is in jeopardy because there aren't powerful people defending those whose interests are just pushed to the side. So it really is now. I mean, when President Obama mentioned he might take a look at tax deductions for private corporate jets, within 48 hours, there was a New York Times ad saying private jet industry mobilizes. and so agribusiness is watching, and the military-industrial complex is watching, and everyone's watching for their own interests here. And the faith community, fortunately, has come together around this crisis, even people who disagree on other things, because somebody has to watch out for what happens to the poor. And I read to the president this text from Isaiah chapter 10, which I think must have occurred in a previous budget debate at some point in ancient times. It says, "Woe to you legislators of infamous laws who refuse justice to the unfortunate, who cheat the poor among my people of their rights, who make the widows their prey and rob the orphan." That's what's happening right now. So from a scriptural point of view, I say, woe to you legislators.
But Jim Wallace, all of those people that we both referred to, the people that are these Tea Party legislators in the Republican House and others, who are about to impoverish millions and millions of their fellow Americans completely unnecessarily for some abstraction known as a deficit that's largely a hoax. We should actually be stimulating the economy or spending money, not cutting. But that's beside the point. The point I wanted to make is that everybody is an American. They live in this community that's called America, that's based on the mythology of the American dream, the middle class, Horatio Alger, all of that notion of a meritocracy. That's all out the window. So at what point do you think there's a obviously we would hope that a moral appeal would work, but how about a cultural appeal to saying, you know, what have we become? Do you really want to live in a third world country? Do you want to step over your fellow American who's lying on the street in front of a restaurant that you're going to, an appetizer will cost as much as a family could live on for a week?
Well, we're watching politicians here in Washington play political chicken with the common good. And what's being lost here is two things: any notion of the common good, which is both a religious and a moral concept, that we have obligations to each other, but also any defense of those who are outside places of political clout. So what's going to happen to us is increasingly we're going to see social inequality grow. And so there'll be a flurry of economic activity at the top and increasingly a polarization in the country with more and more people slipping into poverty. We're at a place now where the gulf is wider than it's been since any time for almost 100 years, and that's going to widen further now. And that chasm and that gap means a real loss of quality of life for our citizens. And yet the busiest restaurants at the top are acting unfazed by this. So I really think there's a real social crisis now. Inequality is a fundamental religious and moral issue, and it's growing like never before, and these decisions are just accelerating all of that.
Well, Jim Wallace, on today's program, the president has taken a beating from our first guest, Paul Light, and then Jeffrey Sachs really went after him and suggested that he's destroying the legacy of the Democratic Party and opening up the possibility of a third-party challenge, and that the two parties are both corporate-owned and they both deserve to go down. You've met with the president. What's your feeling about him as a human being, as a man of conscience? I've always assumed that he was a decent guy.
Well, in the meeting with the president last week, we had faith leaders from across the entire spectrum. The Catholic Conference, National Association of Evangelicals, Salvation Army. It was hardly a religious left coalition. and he said to us that the sacrifice should not be borne principally by the least of these. He's quoting the Gospel of Matthew there, which, of course, we all knew, and that's why we were there, when Jesus says, as you've done to the least of these, you've done to me. Now, Gene Sperling was there, his whole economic team, and they were saying they agreed with our principles in the circle of protection that the poorest and most vulnerable have to be protected. But we won't know until tomorrow or the next day, what the fate of those people are. I do know this, that if you cut $1 trillion and $1.8 trillion more, almost $3 trillion, and you don't even close corporate tax loopholes or address military spending, the sacrifice will fall on those least able to survive that sacrifice. And so, the devil is in the details, they always say, and I think now literally so. And so if the president and the Democrats, too, don't find their voice and don't protect those who are most vulnerable here, I think it is an indictment on really the whole political system, which seems to only listen to those who have such enormous resources. So, we're going to need a movement here, a movement of conscience, of people of faith and people of goodwill in defense of the common good, which is being sacrificed. As I said before, this is not just a broken system. It's a corrupt system. And it is really under the control of those who run the economy. And, I have these CEOs, the World Economic Forum, who come and sometimes they come and talk to me like Nicodemus at night. They're confessing the sins of their own banks and the rest. And so even some of them realize what's happening now is just wrong. And so there's going to be a need for really a prophetic movement of truth telling to see where we've come. This is in some sense we're almost no longer a democracy anymore, because corporations are now regarded by the Supreme Court as persons, but these persons never die. They just go on right. and on.
Well, but at the end of the day,
is so strong now.
Sure, but at the end of the day, if the race is between money and people, there are more people than there are people with money. And really,
that means movement. That's
people have got to wake up, and they've got to take their own destinies in their hand and not be victims. I mean, don't you think? I've got to leave you now.
That's why just lobbying in Washington in this present climate won't do it. There's got to be a social movement now to change the dynamics of power in this nation.
I thank you so much for joining us, Jim Wallace.
Thank you.
Again, Jim Wallace, President and CEO of Sojourners, Editor-in-Chief of Sojourners Magazine, and the author of Rediscovering Values on Wall Street, Main Street, and Your Street, A Moral Compass for the New Economy. So what did we learn on Background Briefing today? Well, we began with an expert on government, Paul Light, to talk about the politics of it and of this hostage crisis on Capitol Hill that seems to be about to end. Obviously, on Wednesday, the Social Security checks have to go out and the government's run out of money. But the amazing thing is, and this is what we discussed, is how come the Republicans who brought on this artificial crisis, manufactured it, used it to extort demands, how do they win? How come the public hasn't turned against him? And it appears that the public is basically disgusted with all politicians, and perhaps to some extent because of our press having to give everything equal sides, that the public haven't got the clear message that it's the Republicans, stupid, who are getting away with threatening to crash the economy unless they get 100% of what they want. It's a very depressing situation, frankly, and quite shocking. The next guy we had on gave us an overseas perspective on it was Jeffrey Sachs, who was just in Africa and had been in Greece and in the Gulf. And he thinks that the people around the world cannot believe that the United States has this self-inflicted wound. But he was really disgusted with Obama and disgusted with the Democratic Party, making the argument that, in fact, the Democratic Party has been bought by Wall Street and the Republican Party has been bought by big oil, that they're both corporate-owned. And the sooner we form a third party and have a real party, the better off we will be. He was pretty uncompromising in his disappointment at this suicide pact that Obama is apparently going to sign, where the austerity that's going to kill what's left of the economy it will be, a victory for the oligarchs. And then we talked about the morality or the lack of morality, the moral questions raised by, the idea that a few wealthy white men who call themselves Christians, who all have good health coverage and et cetera, they're about to unnecessarily impoverish millions of their fellow Americans for ideological reasons. It is really a disgrace. And Jim Wallace, the CEO of Sojourners, who was recently in the White House meeting with the president, getting there where the president vowed, quoting from the Bible, that he would protect the least among us. That doesn't appear to be the case. It doesn't look like the president's gone to the mat to raise revenues from the wealthy, from the wealthiest, the 1%. They've done so well. It looks like the cuts are going to come from the poor and the rich, laughing all the way to the bank. And that's America today. I would like to thank producer Spencer Downing and Kim Nassiter. This program is available at ianmasters.com, where you can sign up for podcasts and contact me. And I'll be back tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.